Good morning. My name is Norita Bukunda. I'm a member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Porter. I'm a member of the committee representing the IC and coming from the team now.
Good morning. I'm Denita Kappas-Lowden. I'm also a member of the committee, DA, from Hawking.
Good morning, I'm Jody Petrus from the Department of Higher Education and Training. My colleague Kirsty Bennett will be with us now.
Good morning, I'm Vamaya Gokoba. I'm the Secretary of the Network.
Ashley Timo, CEO of the Network.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to introduce the team from Higher Education South Africa. I am Risa Tanga. I'm a member of EXCO of CISA. And next to me is Dr. Muriel Dong, who is also a vice chancellor and a member of CISA. And to my far left, I have Professor Marshall Mukhalom, who is a Vice Chancellor and a member of CISA. And we have the Professor Renuka Vidal from the University of KZN, Deputy Vice Chancellor at KZN, and the Chair of the Strategic Planning Group of CISA. And behind me, I've got Mr. Hugh Engel, registrar at UCT, also a member of the strategy group of CISA. And then I have the CEO of CISA, Professor Dima Malaga, with us. I think that is the future. Thank you. First of all, I would like to, on behalf of CISA, welcome the invitation by the Portfolio Committee, and it presents us with an opportunity to share information and exchange ideas on how to better improve our system of higher education and training. I do want to indicate that there may be some slight changes between what we presented on the slide and what was printed, and since there have been amendment checks, and we do apologize for that. We have structured our presentation such that the various people who are here will present themselves better. Mr. Hugh Engel will give a brief background regarding the policy framework that governs higher education and training. That will be followed by Professor Malaga, who will give us an overview of CISA and what are the informing principles of CISA. And then I will present on the issue of access, and Dr. Muriel Dong will present on the funding framework followed by Professor Paolo, who will speak to the issue of success. And that's how we're structured it, and I'll hand over to you. Thank you.
Okay, listen, thank you. I will be very brief. I think that the policy framework is well known to members of your committee, to members of the department, and to members of the Minister's Board and the Executive present here this morning. But essentially, it's grounded in the White Paper, it's grounded in the National Plan for Higher Education, and it's grounded in the Higher Education Act. And there are three issues which we want to stress this morning. That ESA as an organisation is committed to improving access. As you'll see from the figures we show later, that if you look over the 10-year period, 2000 to 2009, there's been a dramatic increase in enrollment in public higher education in South Africa, from 550,000 in 2000 to 837,000 in 2009. The 2010 figures, which can't yet be audited, will show a further increase, and we confidently predict there will be a further increase in enrollment in 2011. The second issue to which we're committed is to making access to higher education affordable. Of course, the National Teacher Financial Aid Scheme is critical to the success of those efforts. And again, the figures which we'll show about block grants and university funding will give some indication about why that's critical. And the third issue is to produce more graduates, particularly in those areas where the National Skills Development Scheme requires them. Particularly in such areas as the SEC, but again, we'll pick that up in more detail as the presentation unfolds. So those are the three areas which we want to concentrate on. And Chairperson, I think that the really critical issues are, first of all, who gets into what form of post-secondary education. Secondly, how poor students are enabled to do so. And thirdly, how we can ensure that they succeed in public higher education, and in public education beyond the school sector, the formal sector, and we'll deal with in the presentation with other areas of access to formal education by school. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to briefly on what kind of program is this? It's an application of public universities in South Africa. We provide services mostly to the public higher education sector, but we have a function that is necessary that regulates the minimum entrance requirements into higher education. And that service we do provide to private higher education providers. The key feature of FIFA is that it is a voluntary association, both in terms of participation and membership. It is an association of universities, first and foremost. It's not an association of a vice chancellor, but a vice chancellor serves on the board of FIFA. It relies on the participation of all stakeholders, such as within higher education. So we need to make it. For the sectors and structures that we're going to do. Mr. Hugh Emo has given a brief idea of our commitment with respect to the topic in front of us today. But it's important to say that he's not only committed to strengthening higher education only, but it's to strengthen the core spectrum of higher education, from basic higher education to further education. Where the set is to make that sure that those sets have functioned as well.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the question of access to higher education is a pressing question for all South Africans who have an interest in advancing our country. There are enabling factors, but there are also sectors that will challenge that access. For an example, the issue of the status of basic education is one of the key factors. The issue of funding, the issue of access to funding for higher education at an individual level, but also at an institutional level. But I think the South African government and the population of South Africa can be proud of the strides that have been made in opening access and improving access, particularly for the previously disadvantaged community. And I think the figures that are indicated on the slide will then testify to this. There's been a tremendous growth in access to higher education from about 518,000 to 837,000 distributed along the lines of more undergraduate offerings and then a significant amount, number in postgraduate offerings. So therefore the trend has been positive, but we know that for us, for this to be addressing transformation, these trends have got to indicate whether there has been gain for the previously marginalized community. And if we look at the slides that have followed, you will see that there has been a positive growth for all groups, but in terms of gender, in terms of race, we've seen some significant improvement in the numbers of access to higher education. And I think this is to be commended, but it's not without its own challenges. And I think that's why we are here, to sort of look at how we can then mitigate those challenges that continue to drop the people in the want to access. We have seen also some improvements in the outcome in terms of how many students qualify. We still have challenges about dropout rates, particularly at first year level. We still see some students who do not graduate, either because they do not have funding education. But overall, we are seeing continuous improvements in these numbers. For instance, there was that gradual increase from 1996 to 2006. Even the 2009 numbers will show actually a dramatic improvement after 2006. The slight dip in 1999 and 2000 was as a result of the low throughput from basic education. There was a time where there was a dip in the metric pass rate, which then affected how the students then could access higher education. The next slide shows what I was referring to when I was talking about improving access in terms of racial distribution. At a distance, that slide seems to be flat, but you can actually see that there is a percentage improvement over time in terms of success rate for the students across all the various groups. We also see some improvement in the distribution in terms of where the students are enrolling in terms of business versus science and technology. If you look at the pink slide and the graph line there, you will see that and there was a time when the business enrollments were quite radically high, but now the enrollments in science and technology have actually catching up because of the efforts, deliberate efforts to support students in science and engineering and technology. My colleagues will speak to the issues of funding and speak to the issues of success. Hugh has already indicated our commitment to CISA. Our commitment to ensuring that we create an enabling environment. We have over time been sponsoring the sharing of information to the facility called NISH. This is an initiative where we send to all provinces, to all the schools, in how to access higher education. This is not an application house, but it is information distribution house that indicates what are the admission criteria to higher education. They indicate how the students can then access certain areas of study and what subject areas they need to have at two levels in order to be able to qualify. So that information is very useful for learners so that they can then make wise career choices when they apply to higher education. What we are hoping for the future is that we will synchronize the system such that the issue of credit accumulation and transfer and articulation across the sector, that is across the further education colleges into higher education and the skills sector into further education and then finally higher education. We hope that there will be a synchronized system that will enable people to accumulate credit that they can then use towards attaining a fully fledged qualification. That process is still underway. It's still a challenge even amongst universities themselves, but it's a commitment that Italians put forward. They're saying we need to work towards that. We need to have a compact that will enable learners or students to be able to carry their credit as they move from one part of the system into the other. So the issue of articulation is also a very critical issue. We also are committed to issues of capacity building in terms of lifelong learning, in terms of recognition of prior learning, so that the people who were previously excluded can then find a way of re-entry into higher education. We will deal with the issues of recommendation right at the end. And the recommendations we're talking about are speaking to the issues of how to continuously open the system such that it can accommodate more. For instance, the primary and the use of admission into university, as though university is the only form of higher education, continues to be a problematic approach to South Africa. And part of this is because we have not put a significant tag to the mileage that further education colleges can give in terms of professional development. The fact is that in any cohort, at any stage, there are more than 200,000 students who do not meet university entrance in terms of their certificate. But these students will still close the gates of university. And the simple reason is that we have not done enough to expand the capacity of the colleges. We have not done enough to ensure that the quality of work that is then obtaining at these colleges is of such high standards that people feel that they can then carry that qualification and be useful in society. We need to do more in those areas. We need to empower the college sector in terms of the staffing, in terms of the qualifications of staff, in terms of curriculum development, curriculum content, but also creating opportunities in the industry such as to absorb the people who have these qualifications. When we do that, then there will be a seamless movement within the sector, within higher education training, such that then there are no blockages and no situations where people feel that they are handing over a cliff. Thank you, Chairperson. I'll hand over to Dr. Chong.
Thank you, Professor Tan. Chairperson and honorable members, I'm talking on the aspect of funding. As we all know, funding for higher education comes from multiple streams. There are three streams in the main. First stream is that's from government funding, the second one is from fees, and the third one is what we generally term the third stream income, which is raised from various other projects. If you look at the trends from 1996 to 2008 and look at the government funding, you will realize that both crop and earmark grants have increased over that period. However, the earmark grants have increased at a faster rate than the block grant. NIFAS allocations have also increased with time. The real estate support per full-time equivalent student has decreased. I will show you a slide later on that indicates that decrease. Since 2008, the Department of Education and now the Department of Higher Education and Training made ad hoc allocations to higher education institutions for infrastructure and efficiency purposes. And that amount has been increasing over years, and higher education really appreciates this type of funding. It has made good investment for the universities in terms of infrastructure and equipment. You can see those figures from 2008-2009 financial year. The amount was 1.095 billion. And in 2009-2010 financial year, it was 1.462 billion. And in the financial year 2010-2011, financial year that's about to end now, it's 1.585 billion.
Sorry, is this billion or a million? When I said million,
when I add a comma, it's a billion. Without a comma, it's 1,000 million. So it's a billion. The average state subsidy is about 43% of total income for institutions of higher learning, as high as 67% in some institutions. Student fees average about 28% of the income, but in some institutions it can go up to 38%. The average income from investment is very small. It averages at about 7.7%, but generally, in many institutions, this is very significant. But it will vary from the history of the institutions that we have in the country. The next slide shows the graphical picture of the increases I've spoken about. And you will see that the total amount, if you look at 1996, the total amount was about 5.2 in terms of the billion. And if you look at 2008, it's about 14.8. And if you look at the block and earmark grants, you will see that the earmark grants have been staggering at the bottom for quite a long time, from 1996 to 2004. But a significant increase after 2006. The next slide shows what I talked about when it comes to the total funding and the full-time equivalent per student. You see the negative growth in that second paragraph. The nominal rent could be 5.5% increase, but when you look at real rent, a negative growth for a student. So in real terms, the funding per student has diminished. The next slide shows the trend in subsidy levels, which I've spoken about as well, the block grants. The block grants from 2009-2010 were about 10.6% in terms of growth. The growth was 10.6%. But if you look at the growth in 2011-2012, 3.0%. So the growth is not matching the growth in access that the Professor Tang has referred to. The number of students are increasing, but the block grants are not increasing in a commensurate manner. The EMS grants, on the contrary, if you look at the growth, 2009-2010, the growth was 17.3%. 2011-2012, the growth is 31.4%. The total growth pattern, as you can see, from 2009-2010 indicates a decline in the amount of growth. That's better in mind. I'm not talking about the increase in total rent, but the growth the growth is decreasing. The block grants have not been growing to match the growth in student enrollment, as we have already indicated. The next slide shows student debt. The data from the Department of Higher Education and Training will show you the debt from 2005 to 2009, and it's been all the time above 2.5 billion. Except, no, 2.5 billion. That's better in mind. I'm talking about billion, not million. If you look at the three zeros on top, that is your head, then they will show you billion. 2005, 2.5 billion. 2009, 2.8 billion. The only year where the debt was less than 2.5, but still around that figure, was 2006. The debt owed to higher education institutions by students is huge and keeps on rising. This debt is unequally distributed amongst higher education institutions and is greater in numerical and proportional terms than the rural historically disadvantaged. The next slide shows what we think could be sector intervention and what is happening in some of the institutions. The majority of higher education institutions make provision for financially needy and academically deserving students to bursaries, merit scholarships, etc. Most higher education institutions offer extended curricular programs to support underprepared students so that at least they can be successful. Most higher education institutions' policies also allow for alternative payments. Again, when it comes to debt, I must mention that to improve the collection or the payment by students, universities take various positions. One is to say, you are not going to get results if you don't pay. Second, you are not going to register if you don't pay. Thirdly, you are not going to graduate if you don't pay. That has made some students pay at the last moment. You find that during the course of the year, because we don't exclude students who have not paid, we allow them to write their exams. And the students do not get their results. When the results are supposed to be released, they start paying. And again, the following year, when the students are supposed to graduate, those who are supposed to graduate, by the time of graduation, many of them come back and pay. Where they raise the money, we don't know. Perhaps they add on to debt by borrowing elsewhere. If you go to the slide on programs and the National Skills Development Strategy Tree, universities increasingly produce graduates in the following study fields. I think you have seen the science, engineering, and technology, business and management, education, and other humanities and social sciences. The attraction to business and management has been high and matched by science and engineering and technology. But we should not lose sight of the importance of social sciences. If you want to talk about social cohesion in South Africa, values and other issues, we must emphasize the need for social sciences. So it's not to be neglected that area. The universities of technology are producing large numbers of engineering and technologists and technicians. The sector needs to do much more to improve success rates in science, engineering and technology, including engineering and health, education and social sciences, including social work. Meeting high level professional and research skills remains a priority. And we make a few recommendations. First recommendation is that a new and more comprehensive NIPAS is urgently needed. Secondly, a differentiated funding model should be developed for the higher education sector. And in both these areas, we recognize the strides that are taken by the department. You all know about the NIPAS, the review report, and you all know about the attempts that the ministry is making to revisit the funding model. Thirdly, further education and training colleges must be promoted as a viable and attractive option and one which offers good prospects of employment. May also be more affordable option for many students. Fourthly, higher education institutions must be the many students to enter and fail higher education. The last slide is on the visa provision on the recommendation for commercial review. You will have noted in the review that there is an aspect about a full cost of study. The use of a single average full cost of study value as a basis for calculating institutional education needs further investigation and discussion. Secondly, implementation issues such as those relating to the provision of fully subsidized education for poor students and students from working class communities also need further discussion. Thirdly, an allocation formula based on need or proxy for need needs to be revisited. Fourthly, the priority must be full ministerial funding for the poor. Thank you very much.
Chairperson and honourable members, I will be speaking to the slide on student success. As the slide points to, academic performance levels are still below the National Plan for Higher Education benchmark. We are aware that the average sector success rate for undergraduates and postgraduates in the system has to improve from 71% to 77% by 2010, and graduates produced by the system had to increase to 150,000 per annum by 2010. I think that in this aspect, the HEI points to the challenges they have internally to improving the success rate of students. Excluding the distance education institutions, under a third of the intake complete in regulation or minimum time, and one in three graduates complete within 4 years. There are a number of wide-ranging reasons for this, ranging from student-related reasons of their own personal circumstances and challenges, to financial reasons, as some of which you've heard both from the institution's point of view as well as from students, from the higher education environment, as well as curricula. And many of these are this investigation into why we have this low completion rate and what we could do is continually under research and investigation. And many interventions and initiatives are being taken. We know that 7 out of the 23 institutions are able to meet their success rate norm of 80% in terms of students who pass their courses. And perhaps quite importantly and of much concern to HEI is the huge disparity between black and white student performance. Particularly with respect to while opening access to black students, not enabling their throughput through the system to the same extent is a very critical and important aspect the higher education institutions are engaging. We know that 43% of these enrolled students drop out of the system. The research in this area shows that there are complex interrelated set of factors that contribute to that show that unless the different parts of the system work together, we will not, the higher education sector by itself will not be able to resolve that challenge. So while we have had success in access, we have still significant way to go in terms of improving throughput and graduation. The ESA Working Group on Teaching and Learning was recently established in view of these challenges and is at the moment advising the board on better ways to improving teaching and learning output across the sector. The group has, in fact, been meeting with the different stakeholders and discussing a range of issues, including the desirability of a 4-year period for the basic undergraduate degree to improve success rates. it should be mentioned that the change to a four-year degree will have many implications, not least of which funding implications, as well as implications for the higher education qualification framework. A second point is that efforts are being made and continue to be made to strengthen academic monitoring and support programs in HEI. And here it should be mentioned that institutions that do not meet their targets do get teaching development grants from the Department of Higher Education and Training. But it should also be mentioned that providing the range of tutorial and mentoring and other programs are very costly interventions to support students, given the huge numbers that the sector is now having in its walls. And then in recognition also of the fact that higher education institutions themselves need to transform in relation to a transforming student body, that teaching and learning charter is being developed. This initiative of developing a teaching and learning charter was one of the recommendations that came out of the higher education summit that was convened by the Department of Higher Education and Training, and a draft has already been developed and will be shortly put out for discussion. So the kinds of recommendations certainly that are coming from the teaching and learning and the success rate is to seriously consider the four-year undergraduate curriculum to improve success rate. Because certainly the research seems to show quite consistently that the numbers of students who complete in 3 years is remaining low. The second is then strengthening academic support programs in all HEIs, and that strengthening might be quite different in different institutions. Thirdly, that improving identification of students' needs and ensuring flexibility in the curriculum to meet those needs. So putting in the necessary support, enabling students who are able to go through the system while enabling those students who need more support to go through the system are going to be important interventions, not only across the institutions but also within institutions, given the diversity of the student body. And then, of course, to develop a sector-wide strategy to improve pathways and reduce dropout rates.
The final slide shows just four priorities among many that public higher education has. And these are priorities which we see as critical to addressing the needs of poor students and to improving the efficiency and effectiveness of public higher education. One that's not directly related to us, but is important to the sector, is to make the SEC college sector both viable and attractive. And I think it's just perhaps worth looking at a few broad scale numbers. If we take the average size of a school cohort in grade 9, we have between 1.1 and 1.2 million learners in that cohort. Of that cohort, some 330,000 this year will obtain a national teaching certificate. Of the 330,000 who will obtain the national teaching certificate, roughly 125,000, slightly more, perhaps slightly less given the year, will obtain bachelor's degree admission. That means there are another 200,000 who have a national teaching certificate who don't have bachelor's degree admission. The universities of technology cater for some of those, but we believe it's critical that a viable and attractive SET college sector be developed to provide the employment opportunities and the skills that the country needs. And that's just part of what the landscape of public provision requires. It is, of course, true that the private sector, private higher education, is providing opportunities for a significant number of those 330,000. limited deals with the other 850 to 900,000 of an age cohort done. The second thing I think, which is common cause, we look forward to a revamped NIFAP, which will, as one of my colleagues put it earlier, provide the full funding for the first students at all our public higher education institutions. We have from the HESA side a commitment to improve success and throughput rates. We expect that the success and throughput rates of public higher education in South Africa are not good, and that they are skewed in that black students' success and throughput rate is poorer than that of white students, and that's something we can't live with any longer. And then finally, the funding, we need a funding dispensation that supports foundation programs and additional support, possibly, as my colleague has elaborated on this, in the form of a four-year curriculum for the standard degree. These are just some of the priorities which we think are critical for the success, particularly of poor students entering public higher education. Thank you, Jessica.
I'm advised that the Rwanda is doing a listening to the presentation by Professor Mitya, and I may give them an opportunity to hear through the perspectives if they have anything to say. But if they are not prepared to do anything in speech, I'll permit their members to make comments and raise questions, and we'll still allow them to make an input. I wonder if you would like to make that input before all of the members engage with the report of ELT.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good to the member of the House and the presentation from HIPAA. My name is Sandy Nagar, I'm the president of the African Union of Students. Basically, we are a union of students representing all political student formations and all the faculties across the university of the country. We work closely with the Higher Education South Africa, the Department of Higher Education and Training, also the stakeholders, the Council of Higher Education. Fortunately for us, this meeting comes just a week after we had our own consultative sitting with the Department of Higher Education and Training to look at some of the issues pertaining to access, but also specifically focused on the registration period and some of the problems that we have experiencing regarding registration. But it's not limited to that, Chair. It's also about how broadly we look at the progress or lack thereof that we have made ever since we met last year in the higher education summit, and whether or not the recommendations which they have found any effect on the ground. I must say that regarding the topic today about access to education, there are positive aspects that I think that the student leadership needs to acknowledge. And one of those, in agreement with what he is presenting, is the visible and numerical growth in the enrollment figure in institutions of higher learning, both in terms of figures, but also in terms of demographics. I think the improvement thus far that has been noted is the growth in the number of young women who enter higher education today, as I proposed to the previous year. But obviously, with that being said, there are some negative aspects that we continue to grapple with that we have also raised with the department. The first one being the lack of information reaching those who need to have that information regarding qualifications, regarding requirements by higher education institutions, regarding the career choices that are there and the normal or the known careers that all of us have grown up to know, as young people, namely teaching, nursing and other careers, but some of the career choices that other people may not have had information about. But also, the other hindrance is the fee structure of institutions themselves. If you would have the University of Cape Town, for instance, and having a maximum as per 2010 of 52,000 per student per year. And the Waukesha School University being the lowest at 27,000 per year per student. That disparity on its own has got two disadvantages. The first one is that to those that can afford, it sends a perception that the quality of education at UTP is better than Waukesha School. Maybe qualitatively, yes. But also it says to the other one, you can only afford to go to Waukesha School. I am not good enough to get a better education. That far, I can only afford what is available and affordable to me. And those are all the problems that we are dealing with. And obviously, some of the issues that you raised in the higher education study was about the inadequacy of infrastructure in universities. It is not responding to the growth emerging of the enrollment, and that affects the manner in which universities have to admit students for the following year. For instance, if for biochemistry or for any other science discipline, for first year we are going to accept only 300 because we've got spaces for 300 students in a laboratory. It means if 50 of them fail, the following year we are going to adopt only 250. And if that cycle of poor assessment reproduces itself, it means every year we are bound to take fewer and fewer students, while especially for those that are in the pipeline of the system. The one that I think the department needs to take responsibility for, obviously collectively with all of us and other people that we can deliver, is the funding model of the institution. The first flaw that we found was that the previous funding model was based on enrollment figures. The more enrollment for students, the more funding went to the institution. The negative effect of that was that universities would admit many students, get a lot of money, funding from government, and exclude a lot of students during the period of the year, and only a few students get to graduate. But also the one that was introduced, I think if I'm not mistaken, by 204, was saying, through your learning output and your research output, we are going to fund you. Now that also has got some discrepancy here in it, because your poor and disadvantaged institutions, especially rural universities, are not able to accept your senior academics who can produce that research output for the universities and therefore get the funding. So you find that your best professors are also concentrated on the well-to-do universities, your already established institutions. And those that are in rural areas remain disadvantaged at the level of the problem. But also, it has got the effect that the graduate throughput rate is a percentage of the third year or final year student. It is not a percentage of the student population that the institution has. Now, that also has got a mechanical problem, because you are taking a percentage of an already smaller number to judge how you are going to fund them. Now, these are all the issues that I think we need to engage together with the department and HISA as well. But we also found that there is no synergy between the three spheres of education. The one problem that is there is that between basic and higher education, there is a problem that is related to such a combination. It continues to persist. When students who are passed in accounting do not have mathematics for them to continue with accounting and even college. When students who are accounting have net literacy and institutions do not accept them. When students have got high marks in LO that is not necessarily counted as one of the subjects, but is considered as very essential for you to have done it to be admitted. Now, our proposal is that we need one that together with the government, together with the public broadcaster, we must be able to send information out there to young people that if they want to do engineering, if they want to do accounting and all these other mathematical fields, they do not need to take mathematics, because as we continue to celebrate the growth in mathematics throughput, we are also not looking quantitatively at the content of that growth. And the problem is, for these people, these young people with young hope, with hope of coming to institutions, they realize at the door of the institution that they actually do not qualify. With very high costs, some other students more than 30, more than 38. prejudices they are unable to pursue the careers that they initially chose, and they then search for the humanities, not only of necessary, but initially they have come to universities for such career choice. And the second one is, we need to go back to the problem. Our initial call for the introduction of life orientation was to achieve one goal, that of ensuring that social coherence does not only start at university where students study social science, but life orientation as a subject must be a compulsory subject for students so that they get to understand the country, the history of the country, without them to do history, but also the symbols of the country and what they mean for the future of South Africa and for them as a generation in South Africa with the possibility of living in the country. That's not the reason why we call for local funding for life orientation. But what is happening today is that the content of life orientation differs from one thing to another within the same district, and it is a problem. And we need it to be accredited. Its point must also be counted like all the other subjects. But that can only happen after the Department of Higher Education and Training has appointed a team of experts of academics together with the Basic Education Department, student organizations, and teacher unions to come together to form a pilot that is going to form a curriculum, content, a universal curriculum for life orientation so that it becomes of not only of symbolic importance, but also the significance of the content for the curriculum helps to build a new South Africa. And I think those are some of the areas that we need to urgently pay attention to, especially that of medicine. The level of medicine between basic and SET, again, argument to give, we need to popularize it. But popularizing the center and making it accepted is not enough. We need to pay attention to issues of governance to the sector. Democratic participation and decision making, the establishment of the representative councils that are not appointed by veterans, and all those things that are in line with the democratic ethos of the democratic South Africa, which are lacking in the FET sector. We also need to make young people to feel that it is a sector within which they are also protected and they have rights as students, who also pay. But also need to audit the sector. There is a fear among South Africans, and it is genuine, that the ethics sector is riddled with right by my colleagues. And unless we address that image of the ethics sector, we are not going to achieve the 1 million students in the ethics sector by 2014, as we have all committed ourselves to. We also need to publish those that are accredited by the state. Not only can say, we have legal ethics, people must know public ethics. They must also know the private ones that are accredited by the state, so that there is no fear that the parents are throwing money at these policies that they cannot hold to account, including whether or not the programs that they offer are also accredited. But we also need to engage in a process of making sure that there is a synergy between the ethics sector and the higher education sector. Young people who go and get skills in the ethics sector still do have ambitions of pursuing university studies. And the problem is that when someone has got an N3, whether in civil or electrical engineering, and goes to a university or university of technology, they do not consider the qualification of the ethics. They demand to see the matric certificate, regardless of the fact that the student has been 2 years or three in a post-secondary environment, that is a field that the university offers. And I think we need to engage all of us together on the process of making sure that there is a synergy in the curriculum of the FET and university so that young people who still desire to be more than just artisans and technicians may find themselves going through to universities as well. With regard to the NSF review, we have accepted the NSF review report. Some of our submissions, most actually, have been covered. But we are still calling for one that has not been adequately covered, that of the voucher. We have said, matriculants who apply to universities, first we must have a central application office nationally. It is going to alleviate the problem of local institutions, but also it is going to ensure that systems speak to one another. In that system, we are saying that matriculate and they apply to both universities, they must also concurrently be applying to NFAS. So that NFAS independently assesses the qualification of the eligibility of the person to be funded by the state. Once that has been found to be, the student has been found to be deserving, what happens is that NFAS responds to the student as NFAS and creates a voucher through the ID number of the student. That voucher must say to the student whether you are accepted in UKZN or in UCT or in Bipoko or in University. As long as you carry the voucher with you, it will register you and cover you for the full course of study in any institution. But a student applying to an institution, the institution saying, no, we only have 300 packages for first year students in science. Even though you deserve, economically speaking, but because we only have 300, therefore you cannot be funded. Now the problem then begins, the problem of the institution, instead of it becoming an NFR problem. Now to alleviate that problem, we are proposing the voucher system, so that students can send their voucher to any institution that accepts them and pays for the full cost of study. The other one is the not yet qualified free education for final year students. In our last meeting with the department, we said we still need to engage the modality of how that is going to unfold. Because to other people, final year means study. Whereas final year means someone who is already active in the system. Because maybe final year third year and fifth is doing certain things. So, now, in terms of the DD, I think that is where together with the department we need to then agree what do we mean by this final year. If we say for those who qualify for NFR, does it mean for those who qualify and are not NFR holders for the year, or only for those that are NFR holders? So as long as we do not have the same understanding on that area, it will be very difficult for us to be part of that implementation and effectively and see to the success of that project, even though it comes as a very important project. The last issue, Chairperson, is that there are many of transformation institutions that are hindered to access them, but also not only to access, retention, and success in the institution. The first one is that the whole notion of institutional autonomy and academic freedom, I know Professor Starling, is that some other institutions use the term of institutional autonomy to create a Chinese wall between them and society. Therefore, they are not accountable to anyone. In fact, they use institutional autonomy and academic freedom as a stumbling block to transformation. Transformation in this case does not mean deracialization of institutions. And I think it's very important for us to emphasize. Transformation to us means also transforming the system, transforming the culture of institutions, and making sure that people who are in those institutions feel that they are of equal value. Now, you find situations where we have got a problem today that we do not see black postgraduate students. And that is not by accident of people. It's because the systems are being managed, and they are being managed by human beings. So it is a systematic process of exclusion that sounds very it sounds very legitimate when you listen to it, when this is an academic argument about why blacks do not make it into postgraduate studies. But the problem also is that by that systematic exclusion, we are also contributing to the same problem that we are complaining about. That of an aging professorial in South Africa. The cohort of all professors that are retiring, and there's a very huge gap in the academic leadership, or the level of race and gender participation. So even though the many white academics who are women, they are also a far smaller minority as compared to white male academics. Even though they have some African black academics, but those African academics in the main that are in senior academic leadership are people that are from outside of South Africa. It's not to raise a xenophobic issue, but it's a statistical issue to say, why is it possible for South African, for Africans from other countries to be promoted into academic leadership? It is not possible for South Africans, for black South Africans to be promoted. But you hear that becomes an excuse to say, no, but of course, about 40% of our academic leadership is black. But when you look at that black, there's a everyone knows about the care terminals. To pay attention to that, not being xenophobic on the issue, but say to women that black African, South Africans are not deserving of that. It's not a gesture of friendship. It is something that we need to deliberately get into, because it speaks to whether or not universities are transforming beyond the midwest. The High Education Summit, we also presented our own frustration with the distance between the institutions of higher education and the Department of Higher Education, or the limits. The distance in this case is the emphasis of the department in saying that no, if there are problems in institutions, they must be sorted by internal stakeholders. But those are not internal problems. Those are problems of transformation, and transformation is a African project. And the department, according to us, sits at the head of the project of transforming higher education. We are talking about issues of representation of worker unions and student representatives in councils and senate in institutional forums. Specifically, we think out institutional forums as those structures that are already there in institutions are not taken seriously, because they are not decision-making institutions. They only play the role of advising councils. But we also raise the issue of ministerial appointees in councils that are either absent in council meetings, that either behave like shareholders or that council board don't have a meeting, receive reports from vice chancellor, as a lead. And they do not have space and time to engage with other stakeholders in the institution so that they see whether decisions taken in council do find effect on the ground. The High Education Summit agreed on the stakeholder forum that has been established by the department with the participation of the student leadership as well. But the last issue, which we raised in the Council on Higher Education, is we need a universal curriculum in university programs. Now, the problem here is not that we need each and every paragraph that is taught in law to be similar in all universities. But we are saying, at least there must be a standard curriculum where a student who has done law and finished an LLB degree in the University of Durban is not told to start a third year in the University of KwaZulu-Natal. That is the problem. If you have done law in fact, it must not be taken that because you have done third year in fact law, therefore you qualify without question to enter into the University of Durban, but it cannot happen like that. So, when we say we need a universal curriculum, we are saying we need a curriculum that speaks to one another. Where I know if a university in the a student in the Northwest University is doing BCO accounting first year, I know that the student has done modules A, B, C, and D. The content may differ, but the level, the standard, and at least the curriculum must be universal, so that a student who wants to move and leave a university is not imprisoned in an institution simply because there's nowhere else they can be admitted because of perceived law standards in other institutions. As this relates to the issues raised by the leadership of KISA here, we are in agreement with almost all of them. But we are open to engagement. We have always done so in the past. Together with the department, we have always done so in the past. But all we are calling for in this house is that at least there must be further engagement to have that sound extending meeting where all of us are going to continue to come and present ourselves through the portfolio committee with regard to progress being made, some of the frustrations, and some of the issues that we think are issues specifically of the legislature, including that of free higher education, which I think rests with this house as well to pursue even further. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Members can now engage in the presentation by Hisa and the input of the student even
you
call.
Thank you for I've already stated to you that I'm going to be so some of the questions I'm here on record.
who is not asking questions, must not feel bad, not asking questions and leaving. The last time we were addressed by NSPA, we were told that they had set aside 33% of funding to assist students with registration fees. I would like representatives of GISA to report to them, because as we speak now, we still hear of students who are unable to register because registration fees demanded. I have a specific case, a parent who came to our office with a salary advice of 1,700 per month, a security guard with a daughter with 4 A's and 3 B's, admitted at the University of Limpopo Medusa, but couldn't register because they want registration fees. There are others, many others that we hear about. Where is the breakdown there? Is there no communication between leaders of institutions and NSPA? I said to that mother, no, they can't change away. They can't change the daughter away because there is money set aside for your daughter. And means that just a space day, 1,700 per month, they need 5,000. If we just get an explanation on that one. The second thing that I want to talk about, the statistics that and figures that were given, I have a feeling that were given very old information. And I don't hear those figures, you say between 2000 and 2006. 2006 means very little for us now as a committee, as we sit here. When there was an attempt on us, when we were talking about debt, at least we moved up to 2009. 2009 is still too old for us. Where is 2008? Where is 2009? Where is 2010? Because already the results are out, so we could have that information. I wanted to understand the proposal on differentiated funding models. I don't know what that means. A little bit big English for me, I guess. What is the recommendation here? But also just to echo what the representative of students said, the issue of Central Applications Office. It is something that makes a lot of sense for me. I mean, during our time, we went to universities, institutions of higher learning, with a promissory note from the funder, whether it was SACC or Institutional Regulation for states are doing those things. I had an admission letter, in the other hand, I had a letter that says this student has a buzzer to register him or her. Now, when starting to say higher-educated institutions are not necessarily accessible, I hear that the HISA has a problem with that. Maybe we could get more information. Because somewhere in one of the slides they say it's not supported. If we just get some kind of indication. The issue of writing of text, whose recommendation is that text be written off? I'm not very sure. Because for me, again, something that will happen in schools is being addressed now, where they will say you must, you know, students who do this, they must be exempted from fees. And it always brings a problem for me. If you exempt, somebody must come and make of that. Otherwise, people are just left with, you know, these are unfunded mandates. I want to know who's proposing. Because for me, if it's department, yes, right above, but the department must come and put something in it. You can't just write off a debt of 2 billion and hope to survive. Budgets are based on realities of institutions. Who is proposing that? Maybe I should pause for that.
Thank you, Chair. Last time Mr. was here, Professor Malaga was very not happy with me for something that he thought I misunderstood. Maybe today we can
although I have forgotten what it was about, but to the extent that each time you see me, you are worried about that, maybe today you can. Thank you, Chair. For reasons of consistency and history, if you like, let me just go back to his presentation of 2009 by Dr. where he told us that the issue with his benchmarking report was to the effect that first year learners at university suffered from literacy and numeracy problems. Now, I want to understand from that point of view whether that has any impact on the success that the professor was talking about. Where are the still starting located? I understand the basic education and all that it is trying to do and so on, but obviously that will depend in the next 20 years, 15, whatever it is. So to what extent is that benchmarking thing, report impacting on the success of the university? The second one, his media presentation was 2010, when it was around issues of transformation. I even agitated at the time that I don't understand what transformation means if it does not speak to specific issues. Again, if you take transformation and all the things that were put in place to make transformation happen, one of those tools was the measures of universities and institutions of higher learning. And maybe institutions of higher learning was more also to, as the leader of the student movement, it was movement at my time, so forget my language, forgive me for the language. But the issue is measures were also meant to create efficiency and effectiveness between and amongst institutions of higher learning. Obviously, issues of articulation and all of those things. In terms of access and everything else, how is that? What are the methods working towards achieving what they were meant to achieve? 2011, you are coming with access. So we come from benchmarking in terms of literacy, numeracy. You know, so I'm trying to understand whether each year there's a flavor of the year type of, and where is the consistency, where are we going to? I want us to understand that all of these things should be enablers of access and success. And of course the issue of differentiation when it comes to NSFAS, for me it is not enough for HISA to speak about a new comprehensive NSFAS. I do not understand what that means. So what is that? If you unpack it, what is it? What makes it comprehensive? And then if it is comprehensive, what makes it helpful and useful? And if it is new, what makes it efficient and effective? Again, the issue of differentiated funding that that my colleague spoke about, I agree that there ought to be that, but it is based on what? It is differentiated in terms of students, is it differentiation in terms of institutions? At these institutions, they have met. You've got the South and the North in one institution. You've got institutions that have taken the same name of the other, and they have never stopped being what they were before they met. And so we're dealing with a cocktail of cultures and everything in institutions. So what is the differentiation based on? Is it on students, on institutions, on history, on future, on vision, on mission? What is on strategy? What is the differentiation all about? The last one for me is, last year on the summit we had in the last day some nice, I don't know why he said that won't have anything for us this year, there were some nice things that you gave us, and one of those nice ones was HISA, HIV and so on. I just want to hear about issues of access to success and HIV in terms of the students. What is the impact in terms of that?
Let me start with the question of federal nature. Under your recommendations, you, a lot of things that you have said, that say you would appreciate that some of us serve in both committees. What aspects specifically in your view must be improved in basic education to enhance the access? And the second question concerns funding. Somewhere you talk of alternative payment, I must have missed what you meant by alternative payment. And also, you know, this whole hemophilia science, recently I've met quite a number of students who can't register because, or can't even get funding from NFI. Because the funds have been held by institutions. And in some instances, finally, a student, not finally those who complete their studies, but are owing institutions, their results have been withheld. They can't apply for jobs. And I'm just interested to know how you deal with these specific cases. And now let me stop there for I'll come for another bite. Thank you.
Okay. I thought your cue was pretty long for your mission, but I just keep at the age and they don't have to be much interested in the report or what they read on paper, but when they appear before committees, they may not be that harsh. And I think that they were not the harshness of it. It's not meant to be like that. We're just asking questions for understanding and to help shape whatever policy that should be there. I think there has been a multiple from the representative of the students, of our staff. But just for the insight, just to clarify certain things in terms of how in their own situation they are handling. You told in your presentation about the increased involvement that has been there in the recent years. And that how you coping with that in terms of infrastructure by yourself. How are you affecting it? Because you can't undermine that. You can't say as long as they exist, that's why they stay and so on. It's not your issue. But that is changing to them. Dropping out in the first year of their class to some degree. It's not a different matter. As you get concerned about the dropout rate, it should include amongst other issues of where they stay in and so on. And your learning method is going to that extent. The second is that you want to improve or produce more in the high level to meet the growing economy. So far, are you aware of what competition has made? It should be taken for granted that we understand what the economy demands of you. You must be able to put that broader picture to think this is what the economy demands and this is what we are able to give. Now it may be hands or we're not yet sure that we're missing on the economic model. But at some point when we meet with the regulations, putting the economy of the government and the maximum contribution to me, a chance to get a response like the university or institutions of Ireland do not necessarily produce for the economy. With generation of knowledge about without necessarily concerning yourself with the economy, from where we sit, that becomes a concern. issue or raising issues about NSF service in the government family talk to them at any given time. If you are able to see and address some of the issues, the two of you, or in a bilateral of some kind, let that be clear yet, whether you are even able to deal with some of the issues. But let me confine myself on this one in terms of job options. If you register to the family given month, and in 3-4 months down the line, quite a considerable number of students drop out, are you able to inform status quo about that? Are they able to say that this particular number has dropped out? And what happens to the money given? In terms of what we are supposed to arrange in that particular regard. The fourth will be the association between higher education and FEC. What is the need? How great is this situation from where you sit? If you have been aware of it and saying you have got commitment to ending, to what extent will your commitment last? What is the given zero that you say that this particular time this should have been ended? Because it's affecting thousands and thousands of students who are sitting there who can't establish themselves in the manner that they wanted to end it. The last is that the same demand given by government don't necessarily make the growth in terms of the students which will be true. But how are you thinking? If you have the problem that you know seeing and there's no particular way of dealing with it, obviously together with NSF, I don't think that it should be yourself alone, you must be dealing with that. The other element, maybe to racism element, that where there is some institutions like failure for past years, it's like you're quiet about whether it is to find that there's no problem of that nature, or it will relate to transformation in general around very specific, which was racism, as I said, that. Is it featuring or not featuring at all? Or you just putting a blind eye on it, even if it's there, as long as it's not of a nature that may capture the attention of the country, you can as well be quiet about it. The other is that you're quiet about how you yourself are running or traveling into your different institutions. You're not saying anything about whether this theory institutions are running well or not, but at our level, you do know that some institutions have been put under administration. Perhaps you think that's not what you're dealing with, that should be the concern of the government, but I think you should be able to be forthright when you have a challenge. The thing is, when an association that deals with the institution, but we have got our own challenges that we are unable to deal with. So that there is a need for any assistance to do it. It shouldn't be like you are able to run the institution pretty well in so on. There is no challenge. The only challenge is related to our students have to be handled and so on. Although I understand the question I was to deal with the aspect of the institution. But that aspect, and whatever success and so on, will only affect the institutions you are running, are being run properly, are able to meet their challenges, so that there's really no problem in that kind of thing. When we talk support for the students who are under the training and all, mostly the focus is on bridging costs. And now we're looking for children and 4 years and that can be education. What else can you be able to do other than have reading courses? Reading courses to students who come from high school, suppose that high school or university school, they will not pay for anything and go back. We subject them at higher than to a 1 year reading course. NSFAS have not paid for it. No good is able to pay for it. Meaning they can never drop out and appear. You know, because they will only be at advanced when you start the exam degree in the school. At that particular year, when they have to do the reading course, who comes in that particular program and it means we are getting them without being raised right away at high school and you know that we're not supposed to do it at the university level.
This is an item covered by my colleagues who are also on the issue and changing the perception, I think, and it comes up in the conclusion as well. That is the reality that we find children that are wasting a year. They cannot make it into the university. They go to an entity that they can just get off the street and do something. That is a wasted year. So, what is program. This has been spoken about, changing it, doing something about it. What is the program and when do we envisage that we have a certain amount of things? Thank you.
Thank you. Chairperson, again, I also want to ask whether we could get a commitment from HISA to give us, even if it's later in this year, more updated figures. I also struggle to make meaningful interpretation for our current situation on figures that are almost 5 years old. So please check if I could ask for such a commitment. The second thing is, HISA has identified a lot of problems today, but most of these are not new. The problem for articulation, the problems of mobility, etc., they are as old as universities. Please, can we ask that when HISA comes again, that they will tell us what they are doing in that regard, the progress in that regard? We have problems, you say you want to make the ACT college sector more attractive, yet at this point in time, students who have passed the National Certificate Vocational with excellent marks are being shunned away from higher education institutions because they don't have two languages for that qualification. Surely the left hand and the right hand in terms of education in this country has not been talking to each other, and I think it is a disgrace because many of those students have already specialized in things like engineering, and my question is, and I'm all for bilingualism, but my question is, can we really, in this day and age, in this country, in the dire situation that our education system is in, can we show a potential technology student away because he hasn't got two languages on his his National Certificate of Education? But these are the problems. They're not unknown. We know that this committee went to see the college here in Cape Town more than a year ago. It was raised with them. And it's a year later, and the problem has still not been resolved. So my first question is, can we see some progress, and can you next time please come and report on progress? Then also the next thing is that very much interests me, but also worries me, is the cost per student. We suddenly jump from a matric situation, a school situation, where the cost per matriculant is just over 10,000 rand per annum, to a situation at university where the cost is probably about 5 times that per student. And I know you also have other tasks like research, etc. But we take a student that is used to be in a class of 35 students, and we put him or her in a class of 350 first-year students. And I'm just asking, and then we complain and say, oh, but the throughput rate is dismal. And we're very glad when we get 70% pass rate, 75% pass rate. And the trauma of those first-year students, who have been the best students in their matric class, because remember, as you quite rightly pointed out, only about 1 in 5 matriculants can go on to university. So they were the top of their class at school, now they come to university, and again, a third of them failing their first year. Again, it's not a new problem. We know about these problems. My question is just, please, what are the solutions? Bring us what you intend to do, or tell us what we as Parliament need to do, except giving more money, to change that, to make it more viable. Do we need, you know, as you said, a special focus on bridging courses, where good teachers can bring those learners up to a level where they are better prepared for the 350 in a class situation? But please, my question is, can we hear from you, you know, what you expect of us? Can we hear from you what you intend to do? And can we please hear about the progress that you're showing? Not only, you know, the identification of the problems.
Thank you. My first question is on access. One is his views on, or how should the language issues of minority groups should be dealt with, specifically the access then of them when it comes to their language issues and problems. And also specifically the hearing impaired members of our society. Who apply to enroll at universities, specifically the whole argument about mother tongue education, no one knows the fact of mother tongue education guarantees success, quality education. I'm referring to translation services. We know the successes that the University of the Northwest has in this regard. Our student representative referred to our rural universities as opposed to the established universities. He also touched on research grants and so forth. What is the insight approach on or about differentiation between universities? My second or third question is, current figures indicate that our universities do not train by far enough students who apply to enroll for teacher training. How should this problem be addressed? A mention was made of the fact that our dropout rate is improving in the sense that we have less dropout students. Mention was also made of initiatives in this regard. How does it get addressed? What initiatives have you referred to? And then, one of the other things also referred to NISH, this initiative that sends information to schools on how to access our higher education institutions. My question is, do universities offer career guidance? It also links to a comment by our student representative. And then last question, a final question, the link between basic education and higher education. Are there any links? I asked the same question at a basic education workshop last year, and I didn't get a proper answer. I'm specifically referring to, for instance, curriculum development, examination, specifically the grade 12 examination, and also initial teacher training as well as in-service training. Thank you.
Others also, you know, as other than what I just said, you know, children, you know, being, you know, under being facilitated by the NSF program, that they manage to pay fees. It's very fascinating I just wish if his can just go deep down into this issue. The hospital is fast. You must really tend to attend to this issue. Because children, they cannot be excluded in the expression or in the receiving their result because of your poor planning.
Okay, Chair. My question is that maybe my poor understanding. I need to understand what are people trying to say when they say they are committed to make high education more affordable for the poor children. And yes, they are also referring to the normal children. And I'm just referring this towards the last presentation that was coming from the department was that the universities have just increased fees. Others times spent another 12% about registration fees. How do we expect them to get access? Whereas those fees are increased on a day to day basis. But also I just want to share in terms of what is the standard, of this percentage increase every year, because taking this in relation to also the accommodation that rising high skyrocketing each and every year. Because one of the critical aspects is because when students go to register, you must also get an accommodation. Mind you, I'm also, quoting these two other provinces that doesn't have university. They definitely have to go out of their provinces to go, get up to the university. I really need to get an answer in terms of that. I'm trying to check your preparedness. What is your stage of preparedness in assisting the Department of Higher Education and Training in relation to the two provinces about the university? I'm very passionate about this thing. I know members, they are always saying, I won't let this thing down. Definitely, every year, every meeting, I will remind you because I need to get the results and I need to ensure that these two provinces were poor people. Young people need to get access to their education. And also, what I like is that we are just saying this will also assist in mitigation the rate of high education. I just need to get the sense of what is your preparedness, what is the stage of your planning in assisting the high education and training project. The other issue that I want to share with you is that the debt that you are talking about, two of the members are saying, the debts are much old. But my concern is that I'm trying to check whether the debts are the debts from the children who are getting bursaries and all the stuff, or are the debts coming from the children who don't have any support. They are only getting from their parents and all that. I try to check where do you lie with your debt? Because I think we must be able to differentiate it so that if there is one sector that also puts you into having this big debt, we must be able to summon that sector so that you can be able to expect what are the challenges. The other aspect relates to, you just explained that out of the 23 universities, there are only 7 universities that are performing better, they are producing better, about 80%. I need to know which one of those universities. Because if these 7 universities are the
where the tradition is located. What is it that Isa is doing in ensuring that it is the expertise that is within the seven universities, the old perfect to the other universities? Because you can't just say there are seven universities that are doing well, the others are not doing well, and then what? Because we must also have a place to say, how do they access the other universities? Tension.
My first question would be on the slide where I talk about the first time in intervention. There's a point where they say they will offer extended curricular programs to support underprepared students. So my question would be, this year we also be giving the diploma view, what can we do to give it the entry? The end point to the higher institution. I know that when I say the problem is about most of the students are being disadvantaged because they cannot reach the conclusion of what they are needed. Now I'm interested in knowing these underprepared students, where do you get them? Are those the students that have already got access to the higher institution, but you find that they are not well prepared to cope with that, you know, when we look at the metric results, we are actually saying And most of the time, looking at those sensitivities, you see that the air always contributed in God. That is where our students are falling in God's fight. Come to the admissions, the answer to you. That the subject is not even considered. Is there a way of reviewing it? What is the way to say, okay, what are the talks between the high school and the basic meeting about the whole issue of MO? Because, indeed, it is an important subject. But now the way that it is not considered for access to my institutions, the way I think we need to do something along that, and they must talk on these two departments to say what is the dedication around the matter.
My colleague is asking me the question whether Olaru Kina, when she's talking about this in the Dalkarka, and she, in a different context, talking about the nationalization of things.
Thank you, Shepherd. I'd first like to welcome the input from Paul. As I assume, I think it's very constructive, and we appreciate the input. Shepherd, I just want to make a comment on the issue of how we put together our presentation to the portfolio committee. We purely attempt to respond to those issues that are raised in the letter of invitation. We don't go according to our whims. So in the letter of that invited Isa to Parliament, the issues of access, the issues of funding, the issues of the curse were raised, and then we then tailor-made our response to try and address the issues that were raised in the letter. We don't go according to the signal of the man.
Thank you. I'll give over to Thank you, Honourable Member. Advocate. What's the word of the certificate? There are a number of questions which have been raised and comments. There were rather too many for my congregation to even write professor I could get with it. But I'll give you a few of them. The first one which was asked by the Honourable Member was that a native student who could not register at the University of Limpopo, fortunately I think that's my university. The policy of the university is that all those students who qualify for NFS as telling test are registered, and I think that's what the Department of Education knows, and that is what NFS knows. So any student who qualifies as the minister for NFS assistance, they do get registered. Now, still on funding, the unpopular thing of withholding regard. It is unpopular, but if you see that an institution where you don't have any other means of fund, and your second stream, which is student fees, you rely heavily on, you sort of, for a moment, you withhold those results. But I think it's because of the screaming and the kicking that the honorable members end up hearing about that. If I have to give an example of the University of Limpopo. From December to last week Friday, because of that unpopular method of withholding results, we were able to recover 52 million rand. Now, had we not withheld the results, what would have happened to the 52 million rand? And honorable members know that we only get subsidies in April. The university still has to run during this period end. Those are the funds we need to run this institution. So it is the culture which I think jointly should be addressed with our people. We giving our students a structured way of paying their fees. Upfront payment, then you say up to the September, and you get our university up to September, you just paid up everything. But that doesn't happen. The students just ignore you. Granted, we do have needy students, but at the same time, we do have a lot of dishonest students we have to deal with. Last week, Friday, you know, I already said to my assistant that please don't close the door when I've got a female student in the office, because the way they cry at times, you end up asking yourself, what did I do? And one day I had this dream of this student after crying, coming out, tearing her head. And if he gets out there, it's me who was doing something, and you know what Parliament is saying. But this female student was really crying last week Friday to say, I have paid my outstanding debt, but I don't have the upfront payment, the one which will assist her to register. And I looked at her and I really saw a deserving case which needed assistance. Now, for some reason, I said, all right, let me have your student card so that I can see your name, because the way she's trying, there's no way she can even pronounce the same name. I said, let me see your student card. Thanks to Lady Beck. You know, ladies' handbags are always tight. She opened the bag to give me the student card. The first thing that fell out, two stacks of 10,000 bandos, 1,500. They dropped out of her bag. Now, you see, those are the types of some of the issues we have to deal with. And that's why I say, by just squeezing them a bit, we ended up collecting 62 million rents, and I'm sure by the end of February we would have collected more. You can see the graph, and at some point I always tell my colleagues, now that nothing that can come out of this room, we have done everything. So, excuse me? That's what she said. She had it, but she said it's spending the money, whatever that meant. And all I remember, I think, asked something about, we cry about diminishing and dwindling subsidies. Right at the beginning of the presentation, there were, I mean, an explanation was given about how universities get funding, the first, the second, and the third income stream. Now, the first income stream, which is government subsidy, the Honourable Member said, why don't you go to NSFAS? NSFAS doesn't address that part. NSFAS addresses the second stream, which is the portion to be paid by students. So that's what it does. Even when you go to them, let's say they also have got a limited port as much as they are trying. And especially in universities, this thing hit us very hard because the majority of students we're serving rely solely on NSFAS. I always say to my colleagues, I wish there can be a day where out of NSFAS I can fund a deserving student to the full, It never happens because of course more students who rely on NSFAS. You give them the maximum you can afford as an institution. We always ask, do you give more to few, or you give few to more? And as an institution, we decided, let everybody get a slice of those that qualify for NSFAS. And the maximum NSFAS can give, I think it's what, 45,000 grants that NSFAS can give. At my university, there's no year where a student ever got more than 20,000 rand. And that leaves them with a huge debt. That, over the years, accumulates to a point where universities end up being owed in the region of 2.5 billion rand because we are unable to fund the students, they are unable to fund themselves. So, those are just some of the few things which I thought there. I'll respond to. Family discounts, yes, those are institutional records. Each institution deals with it the way it fits. And we have prescribing to my colleagues, I think I'm going to request that Professor Kanga deals with a fee increment. We always talk about the percentage of this is huge percentage, a percentage of what, and he can explain that better.
One of my drives for the house is that, for instance, you come to Parliament and then they would ask, what was your fee increase at CPUT? And you would say, that was 11%! That's a huge number. And the third part is that it is 11% of what? 11% of a low fee base is still much, much less than a smaller percent increase of a high fee. And just the other day I demonstrated the distribution of fee income for the 23 universities. So when then the committee is asking about the fee increase, stop asking about percentages because they can be misleading. Ask for the quantum. What has the increase resulted in? Is it 3,000, 5,000, 10,000, 21,000? And I liked what my colleague from UCT said yesterday. He said that the burden of debt for higher education institutions is unequally distributed across the system. The university who can get less allocations from National Student Financial Aid Scheme, but from their endowment, can top up and still give students full funding because they can raise higher fees from the constituency that is the same constituency. For some institutions, like Mbopo, like Forte, like Benga, like CPC, because of the constituency we serve, even if you try to raise the fee to much higher such that you can cover and be able to do all sorts of wonderful things that Parliament would like us to do to make sure that students are supported, we wouldn't be able to collect the fee. So it would be a book entry and you would carry the debt because of where they come from. Those are realities. So this question of the level of the interest in terms of percentage can be grossly misleading because it's going to depend on what was the date from which that percentage is being worked on. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. Can I just go back on the FISA, the FISA autonomy of the university? When I started introduced FISA, I said we are a voluntary association, which means that we respect the autonomy of the institution. And there are good reasons why we do that. Because that this approach is informed by the legal framework on which institutions are established. Each university has a statute of its own, which makes provision for how it is governed and how decisions are made within that institution. And autonomy is good in the sense that it enables the university to respond more meaningfully to the environment they are in, and also position them for a long-term prosperity. So at this time, we have to respect that autonomy. Also, the issue of a common curriculum that you can impose upon the system, for those very reasons I mentioned, that each institution determines its own fitness of people. It has to take into account its location, and the market needs in that region, they vary per region, and also the needs of the constituency. You cannot have, nowhere in the world is there a uniform system of higher education. It is differentiated. It's in that sense also that the notion of differentiation comes in, that institutions serve different people. Others are more vocationally oriented, others are more academic oriented, others are the international focus they play on a global scale, whereas others address local needs. So, in that sense, then, you have a very healthy system that is diverse and can respond to a variety of needs. Some of the needs, you cannot see them today, but are needs that will arise in the future. And once you have a system that is constrained by uniformity, it cannot respond meaningfully to present challenges as well as to future challenges. So for that purpose, a uniform curriculum is really not expected in our higher education.
Thank you, Shabbat. I do want to respond to the question of what is it that FISA is doing about FET colleges. I was a bit taken aback by this question because the reorganization and the separation of basic education and higher education and training is a recent phenomenon that Parliament knows about. In the past, the further education colleges were under the domain of the province, not the national ministry, under which the universities always resided. It is only fairly recently that the skills sector, further education sector, and the university sector has been put under one ministry. And the ministry is still grappling with how to make these entities a unitary entity. That then there's a seamless working together and a flow that links all of them together. From our side, we have been raising the question of strengthening the further education colleges, but they are not a responsibility of FISA. The colleges are not reporting to FISA, but we are under the same ministry, and we understand how interrelated these sectors are, and how the success of one will lead to the success of the other. And it is in that context that we are raising that question. So we cannot then be solely responsible. We are blessed to work and we have committed ourselves and we have signed an agreement after the summit. We have signed an agreement with the principals of the college sector to say we will work together in building a formidable curriculum for FCT sector. We will work together to empower the academic staff in the college sector such that they can deliver on their mandate. So we have started doing all of this, but you must realize that this is a newly developed sector and it is not reporting to DISA. But we take it upon us that in order for us to be effective, we also need to make sure that the FET sector is effective and the skill sector is effective. Thank you.
Thank you, Chef. I would respond to a few questions that you raised. The first one being linked to the statement made in the presentation about the differentiated funding model. That doesn't exist yet. There is a formula that is used that treats the universities equally. So we are saying that as we go to the review of the funding formula, which the Minister has already raised, we need to be looking at new ways of dealing with that aspect of funding. The one-size-fits-all approach does not help. And if you take the history of this country, the context in which you are, you'll find that there is unofficial differentiation of institutions already publicly. There are a certain intensive university. There are teaching intensive university. That's not official, but it's due to the history of the country. And therefore, if you reward according to a formula, that will give much more funding for higher best outputs or institutions, then you are going to slant your funding towards certain institutions that are research intensive and not reward the teaching intensive institutions. So it's something that we say you must be looked. It's in that context that we put the differentiation. There's a question about the writing of debt, which was not in the presentation today, but it was in the presentation that was sent to you. We decided to leave it out in our presentation today. But just to answer the question, who is proposing that? So I think members might have seen in policy discussions that this is an issue that has been raised, that universities should write off a portion of the debt, and then government will pay something or something to that effect. We are not dealing with that now because it has not really come forward. But we thought we should just answer the question, who is proposing that in the public domain political discussion. The one other point that I thought I should respond to, in relation to the payment, just to recap on what my liaison on the north responded to in terms of the debt and how we recover the debt by withdrawing the drugs and drawing the transmission. There are some other innovative ways we deal with when it comes to graduates. For instance, if a graduate comes with an indication that she or he is getting employment, certain institutions will say, okay, we'll enter into agreement, a two-way agreement, between the graduate, the employer, and the university. That will ensure that the certificate is released by the terms on which the payment will be made to the university. So they are all innovative ways that people apply to do it. Different from institution to institution, depending on the policies that are obtained in that institution, as determined by country. Trying to skip those that are answered already as I need to move on. The question on cost per student in higher education but the classes being bigger than the university. But the teaching in higher education is different from the teaching in basic education. There will be other ways of assisting students. There will be tutorials, but the other ways of giving that is the library, but very good. Students are also taught around practical that are available. So I don't think we should equate the size of a classroom, a basic education, to the size of the university. You can't use the formula when we're dealing with those particular issues. The question about rural universities, whether established universities, and differentiation, I touched briefly on differentiation. That's an issue that was discussed within the differentiation in conjunction with the ministry and the department. Going forward in the South African context, how can differentiation be dealt with in this country? But I think we should warn that we should not continue with the trajectory of the history that we're getting in this country. When we differentiate the institution, we should look back and say why were institutions differentiated in the country, and then and not perpetuate that historical background that we come from. We still need to make sure that even the presently teaching intensive institutions can contribute to research in this country. We are lagging behind as a country when it comes to research in terms of our country. Therefore, we need to look at this very carefully. I think that this stuff that looks better.
To pick up on the questions related to teaching and learning and students, some of them. On the issue of extended programs, I think maybe it's important to distinguish that there are different kinds of active programs. So certainly universities have one year, they can be called different things, access programs, reading programs, foundation programs, which is a 1 year standalone and then entry into ACG. Those are not funded by the department as part of the access foundation. Those programs where they exist in universities would be typically funded outside. So they might be donor funding for specific areas. The access programs that are funded by the department and I think have the majority of students are the extended programs in which typically the first year is offered over 2 years. Now the issue about how to support students is twofold. One is that those foundational access programs of whichever type require substantial input to assist the students who would be typically coming from poorer schools, from more disadvantaged backgrounds, try and prepare them to enter into mainstream of whichever kind. But there's another factor that impacts on the dropout and failure rate, and that is those students who can't make it into the mainstream, then requiring support further down the line, in second and third year. So, in effect, students require support across the program, or the program in different ways. So, even though students typically might sit in a large class for particular modules, in those areas that often universities have identified of high failure rate, there would be tutorial programs in smaller towns to address the underperformance and so on. Also, because as there has been a lot of attention on the dropout in schools, many institutions have put in place monitoring systems, ways in which they identify students at risk, require such students then to come for counseling in order to identify the kinds of challenges they have. All of these interventions which institutions make, often out of their own resources, are cost-intensive, time-intensive, staff-intensive. So the extent to which they can be offered differs across institutions, for the reasons you already know of how different the sector is. So I think one has to keep that in mind. Then that easily explains the question of who are the universities who are producing the best results. They are the universities who have been advancing, who have the resources to support poor students. So the conundrum we sit with is that poorer students access poorer universities in larger numbers than they access the advantages. And we also know that low-performing matric students in the degree complete sector are more likely than to access those students for all sorts of reasons. So I think one has to sort of understand the challenges of the sector in that way. I think there's a lot being done. There are very innovative initiatives being put in place to support students. In some institutions, and this can bring us to the language issue, there's increasingly now a piloting of offering modules in African languages where they are progress. And I think that development will probably accelerate as we go forward and see the success and otherwise of those initiatives. Clearly, we know what the research tells us about how to support students. It's often having the resources to then put such programs in place. With respect to the, we can talk a lot more about that if there are questions on that. With respect to the universal curriculum, I think this is a complex matter, not only from the institutional autonomy point of view. But for example, many of my colleagues in emerged institutions who have multi campuses will tell you how difficult it has been to even get common curricula within institutions on different campuses. So for example, where you might have had one campus offering a particular program and another campus, getting it internally into the institution to be offered to the same quality can be a challenge. Here's the issue about, in fact, the sector does have, in one sense, what has been called universal curriculum. In that, the system by which curricula are decided in universities, even though autonomous, is through a peer review system. So all programs that are offered in universities are peer reviewed by their peers in other institutions. So to that extent, if you were doing mathematics in UCT or social mathematics for science students at UCT, or whether you were doing it at Limpopo or UKZN, on the curriculum, the official curriculum could look very much the same, right? But the way that curriculum is delivered could be very different because different conditions, different support, different kinds of students that you get. And therefore, the outcomes from those curriculum could be very different. So the issue of having a universal curriculum, actually, that's not the challenge. The challenge is much more about how to bring about much more equity in the conditions in which curricula are offered. So, I mean, if you walk into a Fort-Yale university and you walk into one of the campuses of UKZN, you don't have to be do anything except to see that the conditions are very different. And therefore the curriculum outcomes are very different. So maybe by universal curriculum, we're really talking about the outcomes. And then the last very point I wanted to just speak to was the NBC, which was sort of a very planned, sort of made a lot of media attention. The National Benchmarking Test are one of the things that NISA initiated and has been discussed in the NISA working group. At the moment, I just want to make this point that the National Benchmarking Test was developed at the same time that the National Senior Certificate was. To the extent that the one or the other was meant to be a predictor of success in higher education, certainly now, as the years have gone, it appears that they both appear to be about the same. That's certainly what the research shows. However, the National Benchmarking Tests are being used in very different ways by certified institutions. In some institutions, all students are being asked to write it. In others, it has been used for early identification of students who might be eligible for higher education. In some institutions, it is used for placement, that means after they have admitted. So, the fact that they emerged, I think, through the national benchmarking test to develop, one has to understand in the context in which they have. However, the challenge of the literacy and numeracy of our students remains. Certainly, part of the explanation for the dropout and poor throughput is the levels of preparedness of the students. And the question and, about what was it that we, that universities wanted from basic education? They want students to have better content knowledge. They want students to come very prepared for the kind of knowledge that they would require to succeed in university. We have the challenge of literacy and numeracy of the students that enter the system. And for that reason, universities then invest considerable amounts into producing what we call, or one term that we call academic literacy of students. So when, to that extent, all students require support. When you come into a university, it is a very different environment from school. And you have to support students to bridge that environment from school to into university. And of course, some of them, that's the journey from school to university for, if you were to take rural students and faculty, is much bigger than, say, for urban students. So that experience of assisting students to succeed in a university environment has to be tackled in quite different ways for different students. And then maybe the last one to say, I suppose that maybe the sector is really grappling with is the teaching and learning environment itself. One may only need to read the Ministerial Committee report on racism to know the challenges that face universities in terms of issues of racism and sexism and dealing with all the groups that have different kinds of disadvantages. I think that's an ongoing project. In most institutions or in many institutions, they are this is in the consciousness, in the thinking about how to improve the general and overall environment of a university so that it can be inviting and assisting to the diversity, whether the student is coming from a rural background, whether they're coming from an urban, from a differently resourced school with different capacities.
I have to address some of the questions honourable members put, particularly in relation to issues such as the cooperation between ESA and the Department of Basic Education and questions of admission. If I could deal with the question of cooperation with the Department of Basic Education, first of all, through the development of the NAC International Senior Certificate Curriculum, there was very close cooperation between the university sector and the then Department of Education and Training. We have recently met with our team, and he said recently met with the Director General of Basic Education and his team of colleagues to discuss putting back into our routine regular annual event the sort of meetings that we used to have on a regular basis with the DG and the head of Provincial Education Department to deal with the real problem of articulation between the higher education sector and the school sector. And Mr. Brown was very receptive to that when we put the proposal in the last quarter of 2010. We had to take that further as part of a task team which is trying to deal with a long-standing need to do what the Higher Education Act of 1997 envisaged, which was to roll up and put in place something else, to roll up the Old Matriculation Board, which still exists. And that task team is advanced in its work, and we have during this year, 2011, to get agreement to a new set of structures
reviewed yesterday on the 2nd of the year. There's a ministerial commitment to that, and we would very much like to participate in that. That brings me just to the question about life orientation and the use of life orientation in admission, and Honourable Member of Parliament. This is an important but it's quite a difficult question. When the design of the National Team Certificate was finalised, and as I say, higher education was involved intimately with that, the design required that a candidate must pass four compulsory subjects, of which life orientation is one. But for practical reasons in the school, the assessment of life orientation is internal. That is one of the reasons, not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons why higher education sector does not use the score in life orientation for admission points. The other, which is actually as fundamental, and that is the nature of the subject and what it pretends to do. The fact that we argued for and the department accepted that a part in life orientation will be compulsory, in other words, you can't be a national team certificate and any part of that, with a higher education recognition of its importance. But that is different from scoring for admission point purposes. But I think that, again, when the designated list is reviewed, I think that will be reviewed as well. I want to then come to the very difficult question that an honourable member raised about the NCV articulation and admission into higher education. We had quite considerable gains back and forth between the admissions committee and the PICA and the department about the NCV. This is unfinished business. All I can say about this is that over the past decade, the matriculation exemption rules have been very considerably changed to make them much more flexible. The inflexibility that they used to have is no longer there, although I think there are some people who are not aware of this. But we hope during 2011, as I say, to close the chapter on the matriculation board and to put a new admissions agency in its place to provide for what the minister in the National Team Certificate Policy and the HQF policy said was the determination of entry into degree study with an MSc with degree study, but then what about the alternative route? Because that admissions agency needs to deal with the alternative route. And that's a critical issue which I think the current team has been working on. I want to just move on to the question of guidance and niche. The National Commission, way back in the late 1990s, identified the need for information to be provided to the majority of those in school about opportunities in further and higher education. NICHE has been HESA's response to that. We don't say it's perfect, but at least we are getting material out into the school in all official languages, using community radio stations, which attempts to show, and I must say, it doesn't just deal with opportunities in public higher education, it also has details of the FET colleges. We're not saying it's perfect, but NICHE is our response to try to deal with that very significant gap. And it's something which we do need to deal with. The issue of getting across to learners the implications of making a choice around literacy as opposed to mathematics, which the representatives of the SAUS rightly identified as a problem, is one of the things which we attempt in NICHE. We haven't got it right yet. The school hasn't got it right yet. And there is a temptation to go into math literacy rather than math. Just as in the other differentiated education, there was a tendency to drop higher grade mathematics in favor of standard grade mathematics. Both choices curtail the opportunities in higher education for the person who chooses math literacy rather than mathematics, or in the health system, chooses standard grade mathematics rather than higher grade mathematics. It's a very important issue. The issue of the CAA, the Central Admissions Office, and vouchers. Now, I think it is important to distinguish between these two. A CAO is not an industry precondition for a voucher system, nor will a CAO of itself allow for a voucher system. A voucher system, such as was suggested, requires that NISFAS has sufficient funding to provide full cost funding for any student who is not that eligible. As my colleague, whom we refer to as the Line of the North, said so eloquently earlier on, at his institution, the number of NSFAT packages is such that they can't go anywhere near the maximum NSFAT package to the number of students who are NSFAT eligible. But the ministerial committee under Minister Arkmark that produced the report recommending the Federal Admissions Office worked on the model of what happens in the Republic of Ireland, with which he was familiar. That is a small university system, it's a homogeneous university system. There were important practical reasons why in South Africa we did not think and do not think that system would work. In particular, that system disallows walk-ins. There cannot be any walk-ins in a CIO system such as is used in the Republic of Ireland. And walk-ins are, whether we like it or not, still a significant feature of the admission system in this country. We do need to move away from that. Whether a CIO in the medium to long term is the answer, I don't think we know. But I think the state of the admission system in South Africa is such that we don't see a CIO for important practical reasons as being a short-term solution to the admissions problem. I doubt that any admissions officer who wouldn't dream of having a CIO, it would solve huge problems. But in the short term, we've got more important things to deal with, because the CIO requires very substantial resources, and there was sophistication from the applicant, which we currently don't have, and it requires, which is another problem in terms of our structure, it requires more time than South African universities have between the release of the National Senior Certificate results in the first week of January and the start of term between 4 and 6 weeks later. In all CIO systems, there are 3 or 4 months between those two events in order to allow them to work. And that's another practical issue in respect to that. To say that we've got admissions systems right in South Africa would be wrong, and it's an issue which I think all institutions at East West would recognize. Just one last comment, I think, if I could add to what you said about the universal curriculum. I don't think that the universal curriculum as envisaged is something which we can aspire to. But we do have the HEQS. We do have the program for alignment of our qualifications with the HEQS. We will have the standard setting program under the HEQS. That's going to take 3, 4, 5 years, and certainly by the time we get to alignment with the HEQS, we will have a better alignment system of qualifications. That won't mean that the curriculum syllabuses from one institution to another will be the same, but it should bring a level of comparability to qualifications, which will make the system more intelligible to the learners, the public, and the employer. One thing, we certainly can give a commitment to provide up to date data. This data was prepared earlier, up to 2006. As we've indicated, we did give the 2009 relevant figures, but we were certainly not going to start making commitments to provide the full data to use up to date data in the next few months. Thank you, Jeremy. I'd like to respond to the HIV/AIDS question. We have not done an analysis of factors and factors, but we have done a study of HIV/AIDS in the higher education sector, the results of which we have released last year. There is a disconcerting percentage, although it's lower than society in general, for HIV/AIDS prevalence in higher education. So I remember well, the figure was around 6% for higher education on the average. But again, if you get differentiated figure when you come to institutions of violence. The same reflections that you see in society about the poor being more affected in violence and education. The same reflection on gender issues in violence and education. If we have to just extrapolate from the fact that ill health will definitely affect your success, we can say that. That 6% that is affected, definitely, with psychological effects, the physical effects of HIV and the social effects those kids are unlikely to actually like to have a donation.
Thank you very much, Chair. Well, we still do have a problem of institutions that say, even though you are an NFL holder in 2010, you still have to pay a registration fee for 2011 before you can begin your financial aid for 2011. That problem is really happening. And what we are saying here is that the biggest issue is about ensuring access. And the decision fee alone, even if it's only 2,500, can be a huge hindrance to other students in terms of access to education. You find that in institutions that do get funding, the problem gets reproduced. Because if you get funding, the other portion that you have been able to pay for the previous year haunt you the following year. So those are the problems that we need to deal with when we debate the funding more or less, or funding fewer with more. It makes a lot of sense when we debate that discussion, because it's a realistic discussion. You cannot run away from it, even from the point of view to the leadership. But the obvious effect of such a method is that even those that have had financial years, I mean financial aid the previous year, are unable to register as the following year because of the debt they accumulated from the other half that may not have been funded. Where would those that do not have financial aid? But even in some institutions where they would say we are going to fund the full cost of that, there is that temptation to demand a station fee. Whereas this is the full cost of study, according to us, the understanding is that full cost of study also includes registration, because registration is what makes the person enter the system, even if the rest may not be paid for. But at least if registration is covered, one person is 1 foot inside the system. So that is the area that I think in more detail we need to explain to each other what do we need. And what are the potential implications, not only to the students, but also to the university. So that when we are haunted by the whole question of debt collection, we must know that in some way or another, we contribute to the same problem that we are facing. But I wanted the reason why here I explained what we mean by the universal cut was to avoid the same mistake that the meeting committed. To assume that we are saying people must be taught the same thing word for word in a country. That's not what they're saying. We are saying in South Africa, for a person who is sitting at home, wanting to understand what an LLB student is doing at first year, must know that that student is doing A, B, C, D. These are the type of models. The curriculum content and delivery is something separate altogether. What I'm talking about here, the universality, is that when I come from the University of KwaZulu-Natal and I want to come to UCT, it mustn't be a problem that my law or my accounting for law, for instance, is far different from UCT, such that I may be forced to repeat it, or a completed student, a graduated student from another university, is forced to go to level 3. Because of perceived law standards in the context. That is what we are arguing. We are not saying people must teach one and the same thing everywhere, but at least there must be some a universal standard. But I want to say that the discussion of autonomy and this curriculum, universal curriculum, is riddled with inconsistency. I will say why. When we say that engineering students must do courses A, B, C, and D. Universities are the first ones to tell us that no, we cannot do that because that program is not accredited by ECHA, which is outside the university. It is not a legislative body where the parliament is controlled over. So if these are public institutions, at least the legislature must have, in one way or another, a right to regulate some of the things that these institutions would accredit certain degrees as usual institutions. Because this is telling me that we cannot have a universal curriculum because universities are autonomous. But you are also telling me that no, we cannot offer anything because it's not accredited by ELSA, which does not exist by legislation, unless my information is very old. So I'm saying there are certain institutions that accredit programs for universities, the same universities that claim autonomous, are accredited for by other bodies, not even the Council of Higher Education. So I'm saying that the debate on institutional autonomy really is a bit inconsistent. Well, you would understand that not all of us are academics, so there are certain elements that would escape us. But it warns me, if we are quick to say institutions are autonomous, therefore we cannot have a universal curriculum. Yet, all students have done pharmacy, all students who have done physiotherapy and all those things are subjected to further tests by the Health Practitioner Society and Council of Pharmacists, which tells me that what you did in that university which is autonomous cannot be accredited for you to go and practice as a health practitioner, and then we, as SPPSA, are saying you will go and practice. So I'm saying we must at least tell pharmacists the need for peer review, but also openness to new ideas, not to read it all the basis of autonomy that can be manipulated as well. Yes, and in fact, our view, the ethics sector is not the responsibility of him. But universities, we tell young people from SAP that their curriculum is weak and cannot be accredited to enter university as the responsibility of him. And the same, what we need to find one another is that if I must use the expertise within this rank to ensure that there is a curriculum overhaul in the FEC sector. That is the area of intervention for me. But here, that project must be driven by the Department of Higher Education and Training. It cannot be driven by HIPAA. Because HIPAA is not, the FEC sector is not within the jurisdiction of HIPAA. They all report to the same ministry, and the ministry must head that project. HIPAA can only provide expertise from the academic database to overhaul the curriculum so that it speaks to one another. That's the ethic from which we are coming. We are not necessarily putting the burden of overhauling the ethics sector on HIPAA. If I was understood, I need to make myself clear on that. Yes, debt collection is a must for all institutions. But it has taken a bad situation here before. Some companies would say, yes, they have applied to us, they are claiming that the degree is complete. Actually, they are giving us an academic record to prove for it. But the academic record that the institution has sent us is there for internal use only. We want an academic record with the stamp and the signature of the register or whoever is designated by the register. You cannot get that if you are going to the institution. Or we want a copy of the certificate. So now, you've got a student who must pay all the fees to get the certificate, but for the student to get to pay all the fees, must get employment first before they can pay, but they cannot get employed because they're not holding the certificate. So now, these are certain very technical questions that I think we need to find one another on. To say if this produces unemployment unintendedly, why do universities have the obligation to make sure that their financial stable? At the same time, therefore, the responsibility to society as well, to ensure that they do not reproduce the societal problems that they see in society. So, we need to come up with innovative ways of finding one another there. This is a problem with life orientation that is a moderated internal in school. We are faced with problems. I don't know if the leadership of HISA is aware. Some students have been sent away. Just this year, dealing with some of these cases, the few cases, where a student says, I have looked at my A and B, but our own teacher did not submit the mark for LO. Therefore, LO is not featuring in my statement, and I cannot be admitted anyway. Now, we are saying if LO was a standard subject offered and regulated by or accredited by UMANU as well as part of the rest, we wouldn't be having some of those problems, not to say that it was going to be a perfect system, but already it has started to show that the problems, administrative problems that are there in some of the schools, are hitting very on the students. Let us understand that LO is not achieving. achieving what we have intended it to achieve, which is to contribute to social cohesion in South Africa, not to let kids run and then therefore think because they are good debaters and all these other things, then therefore they have passed with them. The one that I think is very important here is the NFR's okay, funding for foundation and bridging courses. I think Professor Vital has been able to explain in detail how they differ from one another. But we are saying beyond funding for foundation and extended curriculum, because there are extended curricula where a student, because of performance, is said instead of taking a BSc over 3 years, take it for 4 years. It's not a foundation. But you might have lessening the number of modules the student must do per year. We are saying those students must be funded, but also one question we are not paying attention to is the funding of BTEC students in University of Technology. Because NFR does not give funding beyond your junior degree or beyond your diploma. In some institutions they do fund BTEC, in some institutions they do not, and we find a problem in that. Because there is no decrease between the diploma and the BTEC. And those students who want to do BTEC are unfunded, but at the same time they do not have degrees. Yes, NFR says it's fun until your degree. So we are saying some of those things need to be corrected. Because it doesn't mean because you want to do BTEC, you are not a needy student. It kind of has an honor degree in a university where already you have obtained a degree and you are funded by NFR. So there's a huge need for BTEC students to be funded, and we need to discuss the modalities how that can be done between ourselves and NFR. The contributing factor to failure, huge failure in institutions, it's one very important thing here, the language barrier. We are not saying young people don't understand English. We hope we will be discussing. But the problem here is that both the students in some instances and the lecturer speak English as a fair or whatever language. The lecturer is not South African, it's from somewhere in Europe, maybe from Greece, from the Czech Republic. His or her pronunciation of English is very much difficult for the student. By the time the semester is over, the student is only getting to understand the lecturer. Some students are very, look very minor, yet they are still an implication. The last one is the one about racism in institutions. One man who tried to simplify in racism. What's the racism in Japan and Canada? You see, there is this knowledge that this person is racist, but now you must produce tell with evidence that this person is racist. You know, the same with witchcraft. You don't necessarily have to put evidence, send them with evidence to say, you know, you can fly in the room, whatever the field are. But I'm saying there are some visible signs in the manner in which staff at universities are complaining that they're being pushed out of systems, in the manner in which staff are complaining about them being overlooked in terms of promotion by students, which they claim and sometimes they didn't make it so, that the students do not reflect the social demographic of institutions. So sometimes it is not racism, sometimes it is a racially skewed representative system. So that is perceived as racism. We must be able to differentiate between the two. But when it is visible that the university of Sydney, it cannot be the responsibility of South and the department any either. But also the parliament must think about racism in institutions of higher learning. Because we cannot afford that in 2011 there is an institution because of autonomy that has decided to ban student organizations, to ban student organizations like apartheid in 1976 to suffer. So we cannot continue to allow it. We must think about it, because if we keep silent about it, we are destroying the same country that we're claiming to be building. So these are some of the things that I think Parliament must as well consider as pertinent. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just maybe a follow-up, and I can see that the professors are already putting their books together, so I'm quite sensitive to that.
although I wanted to just comment about the numerous illiteracy thing as a side thing, to say that it's so fun that we should, within a system of education, speak about illiteracy and numerous. To me, those problems belong outside the system. Once they are inside your head, but anyway, that's not what I want to talk about. But to the students, thank you again for your thing. But the thing is, I'm sitting here and I'm reading. I had a sense of deja vu when I taught, and I was thinking to myself, students, this whole issue of universality, I have no desire to enter student politics now, after 40 years of being there. However, students are my children as well. I think that this whole issue of being misunderstood in terms of universality, the whole issue of universality of curriculum, and when you explain it, and you explain it to explain the fact that we did not understand it. I think that as students also you must apply yourself to language and concepts. The concept of universality is not communicating what you guys want, and therefore use the right concept for what you want. Because the professor has already explained what this whole thing is about. So use something that is not going to lend itself into misinterpretation. Say it as it is. That was the teacher in me, that's fine. The last point really is the issue of, you spoke about the finance program, and I didn't quite understand. You were saying something about finance, not finance, and finance is between module 2 and 3. What is that? Just so that I understand and appreciate that one.
Oh, thanks for that question. I was saying the discussion about the NFL trying to convert student fees into barter for financial.
Thank you, Chairman. The intention of the final year program is to provide full funding to students who are in their final year who will graduate in this year. On successful completion of their courses at the end of the year, that loan for the final year will be converted into 100% bursary.
Now, I'm going to permit my colleague to continue and take three more hands. I'm mindful of the fact that the committee must have to look at draft and pause and so on. Yeah.
Question on teacher training is not answered.
The question about the intervention of PISA. In terms of the assisting their education and training for the two universities in Wales and University, not the answer. But also, you know, our daughters, our daughters fight about the answer, whether it's just not here, about the, you know, the percentage that's of increment by the university.
What's up with the paper. And most of the time, when we look at the conditions our students are living, just because they want to get nearer at the institution in some group of content. So instead of say, talk, something along the issues for a moment.
Yes, I agree that maybe several questions which might not have been answered, but have only made through your experience just later on that definitely when they go through their notes and realize that some of them they cannot provide answers, they're still interested in both answers, even if they have not studied them really. But just a follow-up on one and just two quick ones. The manner in which it was responded to on the access program for conditions or bridging courses, whichever way you want to put it. The issue of it has been standing which has been dropout at that point. The response to me says that nobody can then drop out because there's no funding from elsewhere. Is that what we think, or we still have to drop out within that particular bracket? The other is that which one was directed more to NSFA. Why should students apply for funding each year? Simply from the beneficiary of the conference. Why should this, which they are staying in the interview, each year they must reapply that the EIM, my conditions are still the same as last year or whatever. Why should it be like that? The third one, within the prison system that we have, I'm not sure whether it was reflecting on yours, there's this aspect that agreeing with the review report, you were saying that raise funding to the abundance. You may not be saying that we are not there, but it's not about this answer. I'm not giving you your time. But I think it's no noise, yes. What would you just clarify as what you were saying, what you mean, so that people who pretend to support it, we know what it is that we want to support.
Yes.
Yes.
Let me start with that one. We remove that one, because it was not saying exactly what we want, just trying to be understood. We're talking about the rates being used as a cost in terms of assisting or funding institutions and cost. This is what so many track students that your allocation would be in terms of that. Not necessarily the economic profile of the system. So we just remove the government rate. The other one is in relation to the accommodation. There are problems with accommodation in many institutions, especially with the global student intake. And we are trying to address that. And we are talking to the department. The department, through that infrastructure efficiency gap, has assisted some institutions. For instance, the research support, more than 50% of our recent cycle allocation was on improving accommodation. It's very difficult to improve on some of these things without attending to the increase in fees in that way. So that increase in fees also tries to address these particular issues that are talking about. Sorry about giving out. I think I'm done with that.
I think on the issue of the two universities, these are projects being handled by the Department of Higher Education and Training. I think CAP teams are informed to investigate and advise on that and that shared by the shuttle.
On the teacher training, I think the teacher training is receiving a lot of attention, both through the department and within the institution. So certainly the infrastructure efficiency funding had a category specifically devoted to increasing for institutions to apply for funding to increase the teacher production. And also the enrollment planning exercise that the department goes to specifically look at to what extent institutions were increasing enrollment in teacher education. I'm also aware, and I'm sure the department will speak to, there's a focus also on the qualification framework to assist. And of course, in the teacher training, it's not only the issue of producing enough new teachers, but making sure that the new teachers who are produced actually enter the system and become teachers and remain there. It's also to do with the large numbers of teachers in the system who require ongoing improvements in qualification. So it's a very massive challenge. But I think there's been a lot of focus on that area in improving the system. I wanted to just quickly respond to the point about the access and the system. What I mean to say is that whichever the program, first of all, access programs take students who do not meet the mainstream requirements. So by definition, they are students who are coming in less prepared to succeed. The access program specifically use a very many interventions and support structures to assist those students. There is lots of small group teaching, lots of support, support even to other areas of their life, because they are often very poor students, so supporting them in many other ways. But the fact is that even after 1 year, only those who succeed then continue into the ministry, or even if the IELTS then continue. Then also you can track them within the system. The pathway for that group along the system is very low. So it would appear that even though institutions with support from the department and their own resources put into access programs do not by far yield the returns in terms of student throughput of the mainstream. So there is a big dropout in access. What do we compare it with? Do we compare access students year to year? Do we compare them with mainstream? Because access students as a group are a different category from mainstream because they come with different sets of challenges. So I'm not at all implying that there isn't dropout. There is. In fact, maybe it's still too high. And the question is, can universities make up for a 12-year inadequate support if they're coming from a very poor school? Can a year or even 2 years make up for many students to answer it more? So it seems a real challenge there.
Chairperson, can I take some of the questions that have been raised to the best of my ability? The issue of the VTEC, this is a matter which we have been looking at. I personally have been looking into this along with my colleagues who work with the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. There are currently approximately, if I look at 10 figures, 35,000 students registered on the VTEC. It might work on the assumption that 25% at least would need financial aid. We are talking about huge sums of money. And it would further disadvantage students who don't have their first degree. So I think there are some hard choices that have to be made in terms of what funding can be made available. And it is not a matter that we have expressed aside, but we've applied our minds by doing the actual number crunching. And the VTECs that are funded are the ones that are required for professional registration. So for example, the VTEC nursing is an example, where those students are funded because it's a requirement. So those are areas, and institutions do know that if there are VTEC programs that lead to registration, they can apply to this for concession on that matter.
In terms of the reason why students have to apply for a NISPLUS loan each year, the circumstances of the student changes each year. So, as an example, a student could be a first-time student, takes out a loan for approximately 50,000 rand, makes it into the second year, but then receives a bursary from maybe an accounting firm, etc. The student does not require funding, but may require this top-up, which means that they might require 10,000 rand extra. And they don't need the full amount. So the circumstances is quite a volatile environment for students, and I think it would be very irresponsible in terms of the National Student Financial Aid Scheme in lending funds to students to create this loan agreement for a further 50,000 that the student doesn't need. So it's not just about demonstrating that you are financially needy, but also taking into account other factors, you know, like bursaries or, for example, students whose parents were unemployed in the previous year and who now can get employment. Because if students are able to pay, then they don't carry the burden of debt. So that's the reason why there's an application each time for financial aid, because it is a loan agreement. And as you will know, that the student financial aid scheme is probably the only loan scheme where the student is providing any surety as to how they will repay. There's a kind of investment on faith that the student will, upon graduation, make good on the loan that they've taken out. So one wouldn't want to create a huge debt load for the student, because one must be aware of, if I just work on 50,000 multiplied by 4 for a 4-year degree, we are already talking about a debt of 200,000, which is almost equivalent to the cost of, I'm not sure what the cost of a small tax somewhere, but that is quite an amount that we must take into account. The other matter that I'd like to just refer to is in regard to our planning for teacher education. In terms of our analysis of supply and demand, last year's round of enrollment planning with institutions took a far more fine-grained approach, because it's not just about producing teachers, but it's about producing teachers in the appropriate phases, as well as in the appropriate learning areas. It's a matter of concern that there are some areas which will always be undersupplied. So for example, we talk about increasing the numbers of students in physical science, math, and math, but we don't have sufficient numbers of teachers. And also, in relation to planning for teacher education, we've also got a plan taking into account people's provincial base and where they will be employed. So the last round of teacher enrollment planning, we entered into sort of a side discussion with the faculties of education in order to determine what are the new learning areas that in that particular province are not covered adequately, what are the areas that the institution should explore in terms of offering subjects. That was a kind of a new dimension that we brought into the enrollment planning exercise. I'm not sure if there were any other questions.
We need to see higher education can go somewhere in such a situation. And a lot of the youth especially are intended to let people go to study, to help reach a goal. And we have spoken on a number of issues of articulation. And when it came out, we should move to students' studies. So, short, less, one day, the student at the virtue of what you said, something very, very innovative to mentality. That's moving back there, that's what you're saying. And I told him that's what, I mean, the human thing, but it was to be time, just now, you know, at the age, so that if I'm studying law, I should be heading away at the city, immediately by the group of the university. Here, the assistants are put, commentary. Oh. And the last one, the thing that we said, I'm sure, was I agree with the issue of confession, telling and so on. I think that Mahmoud also made a very funny issue, which nobody wanted to respond. The issue of transparency and accountability of institutions. We as Parliament would be saying we support the institution on the issue, right? The issue of infrastructural development. But we're going to also ask the level of scrutiny in terms of how those funds are demanded. In the last 15 years, I've not seen any avoid engagement that can be. We, as the robust government, were going to begin to want to see what is happening. When we do know that there is maladministration, there is corruption, this is how the savings are taken. Now, what we are investing has to have in those areas. We, as the community, we want to be extremely wrong in that area. Our definition is there must be an expectation that this parliament would go in that area so that they protect themselves and the children are housed in order. I never did not want any further response to the question. We exported them, I think, two circles. We agreed that it was held with a very comprehensive, detailed strategy that responds to all the issues that were raised by the members. Well, very clearly, we need to see improvement in all those areas. We have had to, the ministry has also had the key that all of us are saying, let's move in the speed in terms of the review of elephants. The hiding is much. We are in this, we agree that more resources are required to the historically disadvantaged institutions. If the concept is applied, we think that's where money is. Well, then clearly we, the parliament, are in agreement with the professors on that matter. We are not agreeing with the professor on the issues of withholding the results of indigenous and graduates as a tactic to cover money. That one must be very clear on that three. We must find an approach. Because these results are in fact an impact for the cover of money. That is not wrong. We need them to access the now, the citizens, and then we must assume them together. To recover our money. I mean, we can't create the result of it as a small issue together. That's another problem. There's a new parliament to support you to get more money. We also want to support us. So this is the large job for you. If we can go and check in America, those certificates and academic transcripts are of course. You haven't found the secret of Oppenheimer's son or daughter or relative. It's not possible. Definitely the poor ones are the ones that teach the heart and will actually they are shooting from the hip on the parameters. So we need to have to agree that we respect the system of children. We can't go and sit in the council, the parliament, and resolve them between our area. But we think we want to shape and influence one another here as to how we can collectively transform the state of it is. And that's an imperative. It is not an independent or tolerant. We're very clear about that. So that's what we have. I think that I must take this moment to appreciate the contributions of all of the members, the Department of Education and Training, the Faculty and Human Hospital, the delegation. continue giving to the center to the center of more information relating to crisis and relief, and also keep us abreast in terms of the good development and relating to how we are interacting with the energy sector to build the chisel articulation, improving the quality so that students could run there and stop really in terms of and investing to a very large way to find a very dynamic program. I must thank you for that. Numbers were still amazing, but one little matter that we need to deal with. At this stage, I will release our colleagues from CISA, from LS1, and others.
Thank you for the opportunity. Okay.